For some of you, I'll tell you how these started. There were some that felt during the winter community we should have more theological input or something like that. So 3 weeks ago we started on the subject of God the Father and then continued last week and will continue tonight. And I think it's good to not keep one kind of thing going too long. So I think this will probably be the last of this series. Okay? And maybe by next Thursday we'll think of something brand new. What we worked on the first two nights, the first two Thursday nights, was Jeremias's little booklet on the Lord's Prayer, and taking the section out of there where Jesus, where he discusses Jesus' use of the word Abba for God. Abba meaning daddy, and as I shared in my life, in my prayer life, I like to say Abba Ima, or Ima Abba, which is mommy and daddy. The intimacy, and then I'll go to that. Now, we went through the four levels of shock in Jesus using the word Abba for God or daddy. First was a familiarity at a time when God was very transcendent. Secondly, the understanding of Abba and son relationship in that culture. When Jesus declared God Abba, he also declared himself son, which in that culture meant imitator, extender, one who intimately knows the Father and extends the Father into the world. So Jesus was making shocking claims about himself, that he knew the will of God and he was doing the will of God. And then the next level of shock, this wouldn't have been so bad if Jesus had been acting right. But if he was claiming to be the very representative of God or the extension of God by using Abba, he was not behaving at all the way people thought God should act. By this we mean the way he was receiving sinners, eating with sinners and tax collectors. And then the fourth level of shock was Jesus inviting tax collectors, sinners, outcasts, his disciples, to also say Abba, which really invited them into the very realm of divinity and broke down the barriers between human and divine. And so the first week we really talked about the problem of using God as Father as far as inclusive language. Last time we spent most of our time discussing or thinking or contemplating just the awesomeness of our being invited into the very realm of divinity to then act in this world and live in this world as representatives of the divine. And then we started, I think, last time to let our minds kind of expand as to what this means. Then the question came up about baptism. I think Jeff raised it. You know, why, what's the importance of baptism? So tonight, what I'd like to do is just share something I found exciting and then connect it to baptism. And I'm just going to read this argument through, and then by reading it through, I won't start monologuing a long time about it and spending this whole time with me talking. So I'll read the argument, and it's an argument in Fiorenza's book called In Memory of Her, which is a feminist New Testament scholar. Her reconstruction of the New Testament sources from a feminist, I don't want to say feminist perspective, I think she enters the Bible as a woman and as a scholar, and does some discovers some amazing things. And every page I say, my goodness, why didn't I ever see that? Well, it's obvious why I didn't see it. I'm a man. You know, it's just there. And I'd like to share tonight just one thing that she has discovered about Jesus. And it specifically relates because it's Jesus' use of the word Father. Now, she doesn't talk about Abba here. I'm only halfway through the book. She might talk about Abba, but here she talks about Jesus' use of the patriarchal Father in a Palestinian family and the use of the formal father. And some, I want to just share the discoveries that she's made and that she shares, and then relate it to baptism, and then we'll talk. So I'll just go through some of her argument. Starts with Luke 12, 51 to 53. I'll just read that. From now on, a household of five will be divided, three against two and two against three. The father divided against the son, son against father, mother against daughter, daughter against mother. Sound like a happy family? Mother-in-law against daughter-in-law, daughter-in-law against mother-in-law. For all the other things that this might mean, it at least means that the coming of Jesus seems to be cracking up something of what was called the patriarchal family life of Palestine. And the background of her writing is it was very patriarchal. And we know that from the laws, we know that from the society, that the man ran everything in the Palestinian home. And now, Jesus says something very interesting, and she goes to Mark 3:35, where the question is, who is my mother and who is my brother? Who is my sister? And Jesus says, anyone who does the will of God, that person is my brother and my sister and my mother. Now notice here, Jesus does not say anybody is father. Have you ever noticed that? He says, my family is only brothers, sisters, and mothers. Okay, now the light bulb started going on. My goodness, I never noticed that. Did anybody? Jesus says his family only includes mothers, sisters, and brothers. Okay, then another passage in Mark 10, where Jesus says, you'll be repaid 1,000 times if you leave house, brothers, sisters, father, children, or land for my sake and for the sake of the gospel. Okay, now notice there, Jesus includes leaving the father. If you leave house, brothers, sisters, father, children, or land for my sake and the sake of the gospel, then he says, then when you enter into the kingdom, this is what you will receive. Houses, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, and land. And completely leaves out the word father. Anybody ever notice that? Okay. Now, she finds this very significant. And here's what she claims. The new discipleship community abolishes the claims of the patriarchal family, constitutes a new family community, and it is a family that does not include fathers in its circle. Okay, now it's important that she doesn't mean it doesn't include men who are fathers. Okay, but it does not include fathers in the circle. And then she shows what the Jesus movement did. It brought together marginal people. And then again, she says, there's no room in this new community for fathers. And what it means is that all patriarchal structures are abolished in this new family. And then remember how Jesus holds up the slave and the child. And Jesus is really saying, in order to become part of this new community, everyone must give up the meaning of father in the patriarchal society among human beings. Are you do you follow the argument so far? Okay, it means that to enter this community, you must relinquish all domination. And Jesus evidently knows that if you'd say there are fathers in this new community, then that was so closely tied to domination in that society that Jesus just deliberately leaves the word out. Of the definition of who is in the new family. Is this interesting? Okay. Okay. Then in Matthew 23:8, Jesus says this about several different types, but he includes, you must call no one on earth your father, since you have only one father. No one is to be called father. And she, with her scholarship, claims, and you, to read the book, you can see how she moves and she uses all kinds of the critical scholarship, feels the original behind this was, call no one father, for you have one father and you are all siblings. Okay. Again, the new kingship, I mean, not kingship, kinship. Okay, we're going back to start that sentence over. Again, the new kinship of the discipleship of equals, and she uses that term over and over again to define the new community, the discipleship of equals. And if any of you that were in winter program, what Jesus really here has the original vision of the manna community as it went into the land. The manna community, meaning God as sovereign and everyone in the community as equal. Again, the new kinship of the discipleship of equals does not admit of, quote, fathers, thereby rejecting patriarchal power and esteem invested in them. Now, Jesus then says, only call God Father. Now, what the church has done is use Jesus calling God Father as an excuse for a new patriarchal system. You know, God is the father of the whole world, therefore the male is the sovereign of everyone under the male. Do you know what I mean? So we've used God as father as kind of the justification for a patriarchal system in the church. Now she shows how when Jesus called God Father, he was actually saying the opposite. She says the church now uses this to legitimize societal patriarchy. But Jesus uses God as Father as a critical subversion of all structures of domination. The Father God of Jesus makes possible the sisterhood of man. And she says that's a phrase from Mary Daly. By denying any father and all patriarchy its right to existence. Neither the brothers nor the sisters in the Christian community can claim the authority of the Father, because that would involve claiming authority and power reserved for God alone. So when Jesus says only God can be called Father, he means, if you turn that into non-sexual, only God can be sovereign. And you cannot call anyone in the new community sovereign or father or patriarch, because there is only one. And then she shows how we've never caught or begin to catch how radical this is. He enjoined disciples from recognizing any father authority in their society, because there is only one father. Then the last, well, not almost the last quote. The monotheistic fatherhood of God, elaborated in the Jesus traditions as the gracious goodness usually associated with a mother, must engender liberation from all patriarchal structures and domination if it is to be rescued from the male projection of patriarchy into heaven. Did you get that phrase? The male projection of patriarchy into heaven. Another quote. Thus, liberation from patriarchal structures is not only explicitly articulated by Jesus, but is in fact at the heart of the proclamation of the Basileia, I've heard. Is that the right way you think to say that? She uses that instead of kingdom, Basileia of God. The woman-identified man, Jesus, called forth a discipleship of equals that still needs to be discovered and realized by women and men today. Now, one word about baptism, and then I want to just turn this over for discussion. The discipleship of equals was so radical and so different than the way human beings live that I think Jesus thought that one could enter into this new society only by a new birth. You actually had to die to the way we human beings are and go into a death and come out and be a new person. And it is there that I think Christians, in understanding the Jesus tradition from its beginning, have never said that baptism is just, you know, a picture of something else, or that baptism is not important. But to the early Christians, baptism was the womb. The watery deeps where you actually went by immersion totally under the water was dying, going into a womb. Baptismal fonts were even shaped like the womb of the mother. And you came out of that water reborn. And this new society of equals was so different that you could not think of entering it any way other than everything that the watery depths meant to ancient people as far as dying and then coming as a new being. That's why early Christians, up until the minute before your baptism, you were called a fetus. It was only when you went into the water and under the water and came out of that water that you now were part of the new community. And in my study of early Christian baptism, many of the early Christian churches, the last word you heard before you went home after your baptism was Galatians. There is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free, but we are all one in Jesus Christ. Early Christians understood this, I think, when they called no one father, but only called each other brothers and sisters. So, there, that's my stuff. Is that enough for tonight?
And the rest of advertisements for colleges and that sort of thing.
They're in the recipe section.
Oh, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. When you see this, you realize how patriarchal the church has become and how far we've strayed from the little community of people that Jesus gathered around himself. You start to realize why he was crucified.
White males. That was what it was. There weren't even minority males.
Yeah. It's amazing, you know, her struggle is, you know, with many feminists to say you have to leave the Jesus tradition, you know, in order to find a feminist integrity. You know, and her response is that instead of going to the New Testament, you go behind the New Testament to the original family of disciples around Jesus. And by the time the New Testament was written, patriarchal ideas had already polluted the movement. And it's a very Lutheran way of biblical interpretation. We don't interpret Jesus by the New Testament. We interpret the New Testament by Jesus. And so I don't think as Lutherans we have any problem with this. So So when a verse comes along that says, let the women be quiet in the church, or the man is the head of the wife, we just say, well, Jesus says baloney to that part of the New Testament. Is that interesting? But part of it is to ask ourselves, where is our final authority in the church? Is it the writing of the New Testament, or is it the Jesus Christ to which the New Testament points and leads us and guides us and calls us to? And that's what she does in a wonderful way. So I'd say that's where it'd start, but somebody else shares.
It seemed like last week the big question we ended with was, why is baptism so important?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's something I thought a lot about this week too, especially in regard to something you said last week about Gandhi being part of, I don't know how to say this without sounding kind of fundamental, but being saved, I guess. And I'm not saying I disagree with that, but if he wasn't a Christian, I'm wondering how that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because I place more importance on baptism, and I guess that rigidity comes along with that, I guess. So I've wondered about that.
Any responses to that? Sure. Then I'll say something if nobody else does.
Okay. I can understand that by looking at Christ as a model of godly life. That's in a prayer somewhere. I can understand that by looking at Christ's example, but I don't understand why. I don't understand, therefore, the need for the crucifixion and the resurrection. I don't understand. That doesn't make any sense to me. That doesn't seem to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious about that whole passage.
Okay. Yeah, or if we'd say Gandhi is saved, why bother with Jesus' death, resurrection, gospel, baptism?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll say this to start, and then some of you would join in or share too, but goes back to we've struggled with this already in Winter Community. What is the whole faith about in the church and the sacraments and the baptism? Is it to call forth a specific community on the face of this earth that will witness to God's future shalom? Or is it to provide the formula to gather together a certain specific privileged group of people that are not going to hell when they die? And overwhelming teaching that we have all had is that the very purpose for baptism is to save you, and by save we have meant when you die you'll go to heaven and not go to hell like people who aren't baptized. Now, and of course that puts a tremendous importance to baptism. But I would say from my study of the scriptures and of Jesus' announcement was in a whole new realm of reality on the face of this earth, a kingdom or a basileia, as Farienza calls it, a basileia, a whole new realm of reality. It's a reality that Jesus died to bring about. The resurrection was God's vindication of everything that Jesus did in his life and his death. Vindication of his death is the way that this new reality comes, through the sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. Then to be baptized then is not to say, well, I'm one step ahead of Gandhi. I'm now in the privileged people that are going to heaven, but to be baptized, I think, in its earliest sense, in the primitive Christian community, was that by baptism it entered into the very life of this people, that by its life witnessed to what the kingdom of God is all about. You know, and therefore the question of is Gandhi saved without baptism becomes, we had an old word here at Holden we used to use from Zen. It's called a moo. Do you know what that is? It really means, what does moo mean in Zen? What? Just means it's a dead issue, let's drop it. It's nothing to discuss. It's a moo. I don't know what. It's just the one Zen word we learned in one year.
What does that mean?
Well, it's Latin for kingdom, but it's a non-sexist word. Is that, am I right?
So is that like where the silica comes from?
It's Greek.
Or is it Greek? Greek Latin.
I'm just kind of pondering what that means then. I mean, if we don't have a hierarchical structure that is male dominated, how does it make, which is sort of back to Susan's question of like, how is the community of faith, how is the laity be involved in the church? What would the clergy look like?
So when she uses discipleship of equals, it's not just men and women. It's, she does some of the best exegetical work I've ever read on what it meant to be poor, maimed, lame, and blind, an outcast and tax collector and sinner. You know, who were the sinners? She does it. Just this book, just to get a picture, because what she does is she rejects what she calls a neo-orthodox interpretation of the New Testament. That is, you deny its history and just go there to get the kerygma or the preaching. She says it's real people, living real lives. And she goes there to find, ask the question, what was it like to be a woman? But it's also to be poor, to be maimed, lame, blind, tax collector. And comes out with a picture that it must have been weird. Jesus' original community and his original friends that he gathered around. That would be my first thing, it'd be very weird.
The other thing that just sort of struck me when you were speaking of the term sisterhood of man, like that's sort of startling to hear.
Yeah.
And it's a nice, I think, juxtaposition of images that really kind of, you know.
Yeah, it's a Mary Daly quote.
Yeah.
Sisterhood of all men. What? Probably one of them.
It really feels to me like if there were going to be a community that if we split this out, we would really have to pull away from starting the community. One's already
She hasn't. It's interesting. he's a faithful member of the most one of the most patriarchal systems on the face of the earth. The Roman. Now you wonder how she.
Mary Dale was too.
She was. You know, I shouldn't say most. I mean, we're so close behind that it's. Browsing in the bookstore, and I picked up a Hans Kuhn book and read one sentence on one page. That's all I read. But he said, no matter what Christian tradition you come from, there's one principle that ties all Christians together. And for me, it was a sign of hope. Says, if you're a Protestant, at least you say that the Lordship of Jesus Christ is more important than the Scripture. If you're a Roman Catholic, you at least you say the Lordship of Jesus Christ is more important than the church tradition. And if you're Orthodox, you say the Lordship of Jesus Christ is more important than, I forgot, we're all so dumb with the Orthodox tradition, I forgot what he said. That we don't follow anything primarily except Jesus. So in a way, if she knows this, and wants to confront the church with Jesus. But you're right, a lot of people are going to say, well, there's a prejudiced feminist.
But I think the church is an enormous force, and we've done a lot of talking here about how, you know, we want to sort of be counterculture, and it seems to me that this is a way in which that may happen. But it, like Norma Evers was here this summer, and she's teaching at Wartburg Seminary. And she was talking about this book, and it seems to me people are talking about this and discussing it, that it may have an impact on the church. I mean, that we as a group are doing it. I know Catholics are doing it. It's in seminary.
I bought this at Fortress in Denver, and the manager said we can't keep this in stock, this book.
So I think it really may have an impact. But, you know,
two seminaries I checked with in April said this was the hottest book on campus.
What makes it so hot? Does it seem so hot? Doesn't seem like my understanding is a little bit that I'm sorry, I wasn't here to hear what you were talking about. But what other people said,
Is Anne here? She knows more about it.
My understanding is that it's a critical scholarly work, and that it finally addresses it from an academic point of view, where it's easy to discount a lot of other feminists. But she is such an excellent scholar that it's impossible to do that.
Impeccable is the word.
And
approaches it different than it. Most people that have dealt with women in the Bible and the place of women in the Bible have gone to the stories about women in the New Testament. Well, her claim is that's already been influenced by patriarchal thought that had already polluted the church in the ancient world. And she goes like a detective, you know, to get behind the text, find out what Jesus' community. And one of the fun things about it, she admits her prejudice. And is very clear about admitting where her prejudice lies. And if you buy this book, you know, don't think of this kind of sitting down for a comfortable evening by the fire with a good novel. You know, some parts are very difficult, and it takes a lot of work. I've met people who said, oh, I can't wait to read this book. You know, wait till you try to get to the first 90 pages. Great.
Of this mindset that I had no choice in the matter in some ways. As soon as I was baptized as a Christian, I could work out various things about that. So immediately when you say, well, I decided at age 20 to become a Christian, what I hear you more saying is I decided that this is how my Christianity would look. This is how I would be a Christian. This is the way I would go about it. Not this way, not this way, not this way. But when I come to an idea about what feels connected with me about how I would be a Christian, then I would say, I'm a Christian.
You understand what I'm
saying? Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I don't think that was
it's not a decision to be a Christian, it's more a decision of how I will, how my Christianity will look.
Maybe, you know, but for me, I think at the time, it, for me, it was like, at least it, in high school, it was like, do I want to make a statement of belief or do I not? And I've had a lot of trouble with that over the years because it comes down real black and white on all the stuff.
Okay, Jim? Yeah.
Yeah, I just wondered if what you were asking was, and if you were baptized when you were young before you knew any better, and you went through confirmation and you sort of did everything right, but what you made sort of a conscious decision as a senior in high school. Yeah, I'm going to live now. I think I understand it, that it's important to me, and I can. And so are you asking, like you know, why bother with that baptism when I was young? Was it the magic in the water, or was, you know, when the real turning point in the faith was when you were senior in high school? Is that right?
I think it has to do with the degree of importance of baptism. I could,
you feel, for example, like you would have been better off being baptized as a senior in high school at that point? I mean, you know.
Well, the baptism is supposed to signify the point that. I don't like.
Part of our confusion about baptism is that our loss of a sense of the church being a unique and radical community on the face of this earth. Where baptism becomes that crucial point where you enter that community. You know, we don't have that. We think of Christianity as being very personal, that it's in your own personal life journey there's a point at which you become a Christian. I think the roots of our faith are so different that infant baptism was not somehow, you know, changing the soul of this baby as much as while the thrusting this child into this new realm, this new family. And Jesus needed these people thrust into the family because he says you have to be like them in order to be in this family. And you probably, like most of us, were never taught that your infant baptism was a time when you were brought into a whole new reality on the face of this earth that made you different. And then, you know, then the way of the world or the way, and it was your death to one way of life, and you're right. Probably is a very cultural kind of naming ceremony.